Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Right now, a conversation with the World Bank President, David Malpass. David, I was talking with our Eric Martin, and he is quite certain that a key topic here is debt relief for beleaguered nations. To begin, give us an update on the urgency of debt relief for many troubled nations.
Hi, Tom, and a good morning. The deepest urgency is for growth and reduction in poverty. And in order to get there, countries need investment, new cash flows, new investment. And one obstacle to that is the debt burden. If you're a new investor and you know that your money is going to go to help pay off old debt, that creates an obstacle to the new investment. So we're trying to find relief from both the debt service, meaning the payments that the countries have to make. These are the poorest countries in the world. They don't have the resources to fight COVID. So to reduce their current cash flow payments, but also looking at reducing the stock of their debt, which would give light at the end of the tunnel.
David, you are expert on this from your tour of duty as global economist for Bear Stearns. And you and I know Stan Fisher in 1998 in that wonderful summary red book he wrote. We know the work of Bill Rhodes when he was at Citigroup on debt workout, et cetera. Is it the same policies and procedures as from another time and place, or is the World Bank working at debt workout with a new, different formula, a new, different process?
It's different. I happened to talk with Bill Rhodes last week. He's doing well, by the way, and was involved in many of the previous debt restructurings. Those in the 1980s, I was at Treasury during the Latin debt crisis. Those were syndicated bank loans. And so they had a different restructuring process, and also, very importantly, a different dynamic between creditors and debtors, because the banks needed the repayments in order to maintain their equity capital. This time around, beginning in 2004 or so, there's been a huge buildup of debt in the poorest countries coming from China and also from private sector creditors through bonds, euro bonds, for example. And those are more difficult to restructure. And the dynamic between the creditor and the debtor has shifted in favor of the creditor. So the problem this causes for growth, for new investment, is the creditor is sitting there wanting 100 cents on the dollar. And that creates a big challenge in terms of creating a light at the end of the tunnel for the poorest countries.
You have on your website, Mr. Malpass, a phenomenal box chart of these troubled nations and their relationship with China. This is a delicate question, David, and I hope you come back to Bloomberg Surveillance after my rudeness. But how intrusive is a Trump White House in their negotiations with China for you at the World Bank to have a constructive workout of troubled nation debt with China? How much does the Trump administration get in the way?
I would frame it that way, Tom. The issues are the U.S. may have issues with China, for example, on trade, but then the world separately recognizes that we're all trying to work together to get growth in developing countries. So the challenge is that over the last 10 years or so, China has made many loans into developing countries with terms that aren't transparent, and also with terms that are higher in interest rate than the countries can afford. And so the challenge is somewhat a technical one for the whole world working together, looking for a way to find a way through this. And China needs to participate. In the G20 in April, they said they were fully engaged in this, but then getting each of the Chinese lenders, there's many official lenders from China, getting each of them on board is a challenge. So what we're pushing, and I'm glad you raised the website, we are thinking that transparency will help. And so if we can disclose, for example, when central banks make swaps between each other, that's actually a debt, or some of the types of those swaps are debts, and could be disclosed as debts and should be. When Ecuador does a restructuring, as they did last week, there are other creditors who were not included in the main restructuring, and the terms of those other restructurings should be disclosed. This way, people can look at it and get a better outcome.
Okay, David, good morning to you. So that transparency should help maybe facilitate those conversations with China. But in the current climate, do you get any sense then, David, that the Chinese are going to join with your effort with the DSSI to alleviate this debt servicing burden for the poorer nations?
Yes, certainly. So many of the Chinese creditor agencies, so China Exim Bank, they have a number of lenders in China. They're participating in the DSSI with the restructuring terms that other countries are using. Some of them are not, and so that creates the challenge that we're working on by disclosing that. In other words, if there can be more information, I think we'll get a better outcome. Other things I should say that we're working on is in the longer run, some of the countries, the most debt constrained, really need a reduction in the stock of debt. What we've been talking about so far is China's participation and everyone, all the creditors participating in a moratorium on the repayments from the countries. But so far, the countries are just adding that amount onto the end of the loan. So there's not really debt stock relief. And with the interest rate environment as low as it is right now, net present value isn't a good metric of trying to figure that out. So we're looking at ways to do a reduction in the actual amount owed so that then more investors will come into the countries.
So, David, if we look ahead to the meetings that always take place in the fall, in the autumn, the IMF and the World Bank meetings, should we look ahead with that kind of time horizon in mind to see an extension of the DSSI, so further relief on debt servicing costs? And should we go further than that? Should we hope in October to see something on the underlying stock of debt then?
Yes and yes. So I spoke with the G7 finance ministers on Monday, and they're favorable, and I think the G20 will be favorable on an extension of the debt service moratorium. And then the next step is harder, to have agreement to actually do haircuts or write downs. That has happened in the past. For example, in the 1980s, in the Latin debt crisis, it got to the point of haircuts, but it took so long that the countries were in deep, deep trouble by the time that happened. And so one of the things we're trying to do is accelerate that so you can get to a good outcome sooner. You know, this is important, and I'd like to mention other things we're working on, a whole range of areas. And one is the inequality of the current global crisis. It's hitting the poorest countries and people the hardest. And so we're working hard on that with big new surge in World Bank Group lending to these countries. And the other thing I wanted to mention is vaccines, which are so important. And so the financing that the World Bank has available for things like healthcare, and we've done over 100 programs just in April and May, those can be used for vaccines, for therapeutics. And so I think the world concentrating on that, putting more money into those efforts is useful.
David, you know, I don't mean to make a joke about it because this is tragic stuff, but if you look at John Burns Murdoch's wonderful work at the FT with Johns Hopkins University, there's Bolivia, there's Panama, there's Latin America, and then there's this World Bank country, the United States of America, up there with pandemic. What would David Malpass and the World Bank do to help the United States not have as ugly death statistics like these other truly impoverished nations?
I mean, one thing we should recognize is we're in new territory. The pandemic is new. The severity of it is new. And it's coming at a time when many of the developing countries had too much debt. So as we think about the U.S., I think you move through methodically with ways to allow the businesses that can reopen to reopen, the schools to reopen where they can. That becomes a very important part of people's productivity. You want to raise the productivity. And then in the long run, you need to get good, well-targeted investments in the U.S. and everywhere. I think that comes from transparency. If you know what the investment is, for example, in the U.S., Tom, you know, I've advocated the disclosure of the outlay projections of public pension funds. A huge amount of money goes into these funds, and you don't know what the outlays are used for, what the projections are for the future on those outlays. So they become a burden on the allocation of investment. So in developing countries, I'll finish, but in developing countries, we need a way that they can move investment from the old sectors, the pre-pandemic sectors, into the new sectors. That's a core of what we're working on.
We've got to leave it there. David Malpass, thank you for the update with the World Bank as well. Jill Carey Hall joins us right now with Bank of America. Jill, we just spoke to Candace Browning here in the last hour about your new focus on small cap. You're a specialist there as well. Is it about a rotation from tech to small cap, or is it about tech still doing well and small cap finally picking it up?
Well, I think to your point on yields earlier, we've been in a market where what's been scarce has been rewarded. So yield has been scarce, growth has been scarce, and you've seen a lot of these themes working for a number of years now. Small caps have obviously been challenged by, you know, trade tensions. They've been challenged by the fundamental backdrop, their lack of quality. But I think, you know, while we've been cautious relatively on small caps near term, one of the longer term bullish themes for small caps is that if we do see this shift from globalization to localization and the reshoring of U.S. manufacturing, which Candace was talking about, we think that could be a bullish longer-term theme for small cap companies in the coming years.
What is the sector specificity of small caps? I mean, do I just go out and buy small caps, or are you looking at different sectors, for example, tech small cap?
Right. Well, I think one of the important things right now is that you are seeing a lot of divergence within the market in terms of valuations, in terms of performance spreads. So it's been a good backdrop for stock pickers. From a sector basis, we are within small caps starting to see some of the more value-oriented cyclical sectors start to rank better in our work. So some of the commodity-oriented cyclical sectors that previously looked like value traps are now starting to look like better value. So overall, value is a theme that we like within the market. We do expect we will see that rotation out of growth into value as the profits recovery and economic recovery broadens out. And then on the reshoring theme, we think that, you know, there's a number of subsectors that are slated to benefit. So certainly some tech companies, but also a number of industrials that are focused on automation or engineering. Even in other cyclical sectors, a number of regional banks that might be exposed to manufacturing hubs, REITs, which is a big part of small caps. That's a sector where industrial REITs, warehouses, this could benefit as well.
Jill, good morning to you. I've heard a lot about reshoring this week and a lot more in conversations with American strategists and American business than I have with people here in Europe. Is it going to remain quite a US phenomenon? And is that because businesses think it plays well in Washington or because they really intend to follow through on this?
Well, I think as you see firms move out of areas like China, there are certainly some other regions of Asia, for example, that will benefit, but a lot of companies are talking about bringing companies back to North America and to the U.S. So I think, you know, in areas like the Midwest and the Sun Belt, that's where some of these banks, REITs, et cetera, that I mentioned could benefit. You know, if we see higher wages for manufacturing, this could benefit lower income consumers in areas like, you know, retail, value retailers like Burlington and Kohl's. So I think there's a lot of areas within the U.S. that can benefit. And we are starting to see early signs of this, even though it is a long-term theme, actually taking hold. We're seeing, you know, when we tracked earnings calls, we're seeing more and more companies start to talk about this on earnings calls. We're seeing, you know, supply chain professionals talk about this. So companies, you know, even though CapEx has been in a down cycle, they are starting to talk about making tangible shifts with respect to this theme.
And is this something, Jill, that's going to create jobs in America, or is it something that's going to drive the bottom line of businesses that create automation technology? There are plenty of those in Europe.
Yes, we think so. And I think Candace mentioned earlier that, you know, for every manufacturing job that's created, you could see somewhere around 6 to 7 jobs created in other industries. So, you know, we think that's why the overall pickup in employment and in potentially wages could benefit some of these areas like select retailers. And there'll just be more demand for banking, financial services. So there's a lot of knock-on effects from this theme that we could see across the U.S. And then certainly for automation, you know, companies in industrials like Rockwell or companies that focus on, you know, mm-hmm. industrial lasers or things like that. You know, there's that angle as well, that automation and the Internet of Things, a lot of these big themes that we've been talking about as a research department, we see as big multi-year themes related to this as well.
Help me here with Savita Subramanian's work. I mean, we look at ESG as, you know, top 50 stocks, maybe top 200 stocks. Can small cap go ESG, or are they just not there yet?
Well, I think, you know, it's a challenge in smaller caps because a lot of these companies may not have the resources dedicated to it or the disclosures, so it's tougher to evaluate. But when we've done some work looking on sub-themes of ESG, for example, you know, diversity, women on the board, et cetera, we found that ESG still works within small caps, so that companies that, you know, for example, have more diverse boards, better governance, are trading at higher multiples consistently. You're seeing better returns on equity. So this is something that I think as we continue to see money flow into ESG strategies and as companies continue to focus on this, we found that ESG was particularly important during the downturn, that even though we saw outflows out of ETFs broadly, we were continuing to see inflows into ESG types of strategies. So, you know, I think it's a very important theme that we as a department have been writing a lot about. And small caps, obviously, there's less disclosure there, but I think that'll continue to increase.
Okay, we don't do enough of this. Jill Caryhall, thank you so much on small caps. Really, really appreciate that. To get you through August and into the autumn is James Bianco. Jim Bianco writes a wonderfully eclectic note for Bianco Research out of Chicago. He is appearing with us only because the Chicago Cubs are in first place. Jim Bianco, I loved what you said there about tips, about this enigma of where tips are. Give us insight on how unusual these inflation-adjusted statistics are.
The problem is the Federal Reserve is the biggest player in that market. Since March, they've bought $250 billion worth of tips. And if you're looking at the tips market and you're trying to discern a signal out of it about the outlook for inflation or the outlook for the economy, you have to be careful that it's a bit distorted because the biggest buyer is the central bank. Now, it doesn't mean that it should be ignored or not looked at, but it is become more complicated to try and understand it.
What other signals have value to consider inflation?
You know, that's a good question, because you'd have to go away from the signals that are not with the central bank. The surveys of inflation, like the University of Michigan survey or the Consumer Confidence Survey or the commodity markets themselves, the central banks are playing in those markets. And those numbers are turning higher, and they are expecting more inflation as we move forward from here. So there's definitely signals on the horizon that inflation's coming. You could argue the tips market is saying the same thing, but I'd be a little bit careful in overreading the tips market. I want to try and rely on some of those non-market indicators.
And so, good morning to Jim. Talking about other indicators, how confident are you that inflation readings, we just got some out of the UK this morning, inflation a little bit stronger than had been anticipated, but that might be short-lived. How confident are you that inflation readings are giving us accurate information, given the way our spending patterns have shifted so much? The basket that the statisticians rely on might not be the basket that you and I actually consume.
That is absolutely right. That, you know, in the pandemic, especially with the move to online, that what we are consuming now is what we weren't consuming 4 or 5 months ago, so that there could be a bit of a distortion. But at the end of the day, let's remember what's going on, which is the fundamental for pushing inflation higher. We have a higher unemployment rate. We're producing less stuff because the economy is at a lower level than it was a few months ago. And we're stimulating the economy by giving people either stimulus checks or extra unemployment. I know it rolled off on August 1st, but that might come back. And so we've got less supply, and we've got demand being stimulated, and that imbalance should lead to higher prices, otherwise known as inflation. And I think that that's what a lot of the surveys are telling us might be coming.
But knowing what we know about the way the central banks want to keep the costs of funding debt low at this point, do we really see inflation coming meaningfully, Jim, I suppose? A lot of people talk about inflation and they just mean, you know, we've bounced up, expectations have bounced up from the lows of March, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're off to the races and inflation goes much, much higher from here.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I do think that we are going to see meaningful inflation probably in the second half of 21 or into 22 as the economy strengthens and all the stimulus starts to add in as well, too. The central bank, especially the Federal Reserve, is going to go to something called an average inflation target. They're going to say 2% is not their target. It's their average, so they can run it above 2%. Bear in mind, they're not going to change policy one inch. They're just going to announce that the target has changed as well.
Come on, Jim Bianco. This is as rare as it can be. This is like when the White Sox are better than the Cubs, and that only happens once a century. Is there any evidence out there whatsoever that governments can reflate an economy, that governments can, you know, somehow magically make 2 or 2.5 or 3% inflation appear?
No, there's no evidence at all. In fact, 2.5-3% inflation at the core level, we haven't seen that in 30 years. It was the early 90s the last time. And you know, I'd actually go you the other side of the equation, too. If you ever got to 3% or maybe a little bit more in inflation, there's very little evidence that the governments or the central banks could stop it if they wanted to stop it.
I mean, I don't want to go all Nellie Fox on you here, but let's stay with the White Sox here right now just to bust your chops. But Jim Bianco, what is so, so important here is the Fed in their timeline. Do you just assume their timeline is way out past what the zeitgeist is, that it's 23 or dare I even say 2024?
Yeah, I'm going to go White Sox with you too. They want a Richie Zisk home run that's going to go into the upper deck and hope to keep it rates at zeroed out to 23 or 24. But they're only going to kind of do it one meeting at a time. They're going to give you forward guidance. There's going to be no inflation. And then when it starts to percolate and percolate too much, they'll change it and dime. Now, that's not going to happen right away, but I suspect that when all is said and done, they'll be moving on inflation a lot sooner than they think, probably in a year to 18 months as opposed to 2 or 3 years.
Jim, you know, you do a lot of different things. The bond market, I loved your tips work as well. I want you to address for our listeners and viewers this stock market. It seems to be uniquely and differently unloved. How do you participate?
You know, that's the stock market, I'm going to push back. I understand people have said that it is the most hated bull market ever. We were saying that pre-pandemic. We're saying that post-pandemic. But there are plenty of instances or signals that the public is in a big way. The Robin Hood type of retail accounts, which now account for 25% of all the volume, which was practically nothing a couple of years ago. They're in a big way, too. They're in a big way in the concentration you see in the FANG stocks. Those are almost a quarter of the S&P. You got to go back 50 years to find five stocks that had that big a weighting in the market. So they're in that market. And I think as far as to your question, the reason that they hate it is those bottom 300 companies, I think they're still struggling with the economy to return to normal. But those top companies, especially those top 20 or top five, they're stay-at-home companies, and they're doing very well. And they're pushing the whole index higher.
Jim Bianco, thank you so much. Just brilliant. We love the Cubs. Jim Bianco there from Chicago. Combining academics in African-American history with also the operation of it all, Mr. Bunch, of course, the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. This is a fascinating and deeply important interview for the nation on two accounts. It is peer-to-peer with David Rubenstein, but far more than that, it's a philanthropy of Mr. Rubenstein to the nation. David, I want you to explain, when you walked in that museum and you saw your Emancipation Proclamation and your 13th Amendment of Abraham Lincoln sitting in that museum, what was that like?
Well, I was very proud that I was able to provide those to the museum and to help them get the African American History and Culture Museum off the ground. As you probably know, that museum cost about $540 million, half of which came from the federal government, half of which came from private contributions. And I was very pleased to be part of it. It's an extraordinary museum. And Lonnie Bunch is the person who started it from scratch. And now he's the, not only was the head of that museum, but now he's the head of the entire Smithsonian, the secretary, as he's called.
The inside story is the reason the Washington Redskins exist, David, is so there's something more controversial than the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. It's been a pinata for decades. How will Mr. Bunch, in your conversation with him, how will he drive forward the Smithsonian to stability and to a more modern institution?
Well, about 60% or so of the money comes from the federal government, so making sure Congress is happy is always important. But then we get a lot of philanthropic contributions from around the country. We want to make sure that continues. And then because the museums have been closed, we've lost some revenue sources from restaurants and other kinds of shops that we have in the museums. There are 19 museums at the Smithsonian and about almost 10 research centers. And those museums have been largely closed, though two are now open. The National Zoo is open, and there's reports that there may be a new baby panda being born very soon, which will get a lot of interest. And then the Space Museum out of Dulles, Ubar Hazy, is open. And it's expected that the other museums will gradually open, assuming we can do this with appropriate social distancing. I say we. Lonnie is a friend of mine. I was the chairman of the board of the Smithsonian when Lonnie was selected to be the new secretary. And I've been on the board for about a dozen years. I was the chair for about 3 years.
David, good morning from London, or good afternoon from here. What is the Smithsonian? What did Lonnie tell you about what they are doing, what they're thinking of doing around racism and around adding to the stock of education on that subject? Here in the UK, there's been a lot of soul searching around the people we chose to put on platforms over recent years and statues that are up in all kinds of civic spaces. It's important, perhaps, that those people, if they're toppled, that maybe they find a place in a museum and people can learn the lessons of history. What is the museum thinking about doing there?
Well, it's appropriate that somebody from London is on this call because Mr. Smithson himself was British. As you may know, upon his death, he ultimately provided about $500,000 to create the Smithsonian in the mid-1800s, and that's how he got the Smithsonian. It's named after him, of course. To answer your question, the Bank of America has recently given the Smithsonian $25 million, and the Smithsonian is trying to raise another $25 million or $50 million to have a conversation and dialogue about race that will go throughout all the museums of the Smithsonian, the 19 museums, but also try to have a very frank conversation about race at the Smithsonian, not just about Smithsonian racial matters, but about the entire country. Now, no conversation is going to solve all racial problems, of course. And there's no doubt that there is going to be racial discrimination for some time in this country. But it's a beginning, and I think it's an important beginning.
It's an important beginning, important part of the conversation. How are they managing to return to anything like normal operations, David? Because I know that one of the things you talked about was the way that teamwork really shone through. And this is something I've heard from a number of leaders in business also, that although the pandemic has thrown up incredible challenges for business leaders, it has also shone a light on resilience and teamwork in a way that perhaps normal times don't. Is that something you took away from your conversation?
Well, sure. Remember, most people in the United States love the Smithsonian. As I like to say, nobody doesn't like the Smithsonian. Everybody likes the Smithsonian because people have fond memories of it, in part because its attendance is free. There are no admission prices. And that's because Congress is putting up the money for it. It's taxpayer money. So people have fond memories. I do, when I was a child, of going there for free, and many other people have those similar memories. Today, what we want to do is get the museums open again. And that's what Lonnie Bunch is trying to do. But we have to do it in an appropriate social distancing way, in a way that isn't going to lead to viruses or the employees getting sick or the people attending. So every employee will have to wear a mask. Those coming into the museums will wear masks, and we have to make sure we don't have too many people. And we'll open them up gradually over a period of time and see how it goes. And if we make mistakes, then we'll have to correct them. But it's going to take a while. And I think, just as in other organizations around the United States that are figuring out other museums how to open up, the Smithsonian is really the museum everybody's watching, because we are the biggest museum complex in the world.
David Rubenstein, thank you so much. It is peer-to-peer. These are wonderful conversations with business, finance, and indeed Washington leaders. Lonnie Bunch of the Smithsonian Museum, that's tonight at 9 p.m. as well. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.